This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, the 22nd of March. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We'll speak with Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. We'll hear CAI's Patrick Flannery speaking with our State House reporter Katie Lannon, and we'll speak with Will Sennett of the New Bedford Light. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Plans for the new Sagamore Bridge could be fully funded within a few weeks or months if the state wins a major federal transportation grant. CAI's Jeanette Barnes reported this week on a cooperative push by all 11 members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation to help make this happen, and she joins us now with that story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Tell us about this step that the delegation took this week.
Sure. This, as you said, was all 11 members, so Senators Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren, plus the 9 representatives from around the state. And they signed a letter to Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg reiterating their support for the bridge project ahead of this possible $1 billion grant from his department. They outlined the reasons to replace the bridges for both safety and for the economy. They reminded him that the bridges are the only road link to the rest of the state. They reviewed some of the other funding the project has received so far. And they said this grant that the state has applied for from Buttigieg's transportation department is the last piece of the puzzle for the phased construction to begin. It's not the last piece for the full project. What they mean there by the phasing is phase one, which is the Sagamore Bridge. So this grant would bring the total funding very near that $2.1 billion estimate for the Sagamore.
So this last piece of this last $1 billion grant, when will we know if the bridge project is going to receive that?
Well, it was Congressman Keating who said to me it could be weeks to months. The timeline really is not certain. I don't think the government publicizes any kind of a deadline that it might set for itself for announcing these grants, but it is an annual sort of grant cycle. So certainly it's fairly short-term proposition to find out.
If that money were to come in, what would the construction timeline be like? Do we have a sense?
Well, I don't think it changes the timeline. It certainly avoids a delay, but the project already has partial funding that is allowing the state to move forward with putting together the bid documents to hire what they call the design build team. It's a team because the project is so large that it's unlikely one contractor would do both the design and the construction. That's what the state highway administrator told me. But companies could get together and bid together as a team. And that whole process of hiring them could take 2 years just for the Sagamore Bridge. But simultaneously, the state will be moving through the environmental permitting process for both bridges together. Construction can only start once those planning steps are done.
I know that you spoke with 2 members of the delegation about this week. What did they have to say?
Well, they're optimistic, of course, that Massachusetts will get the grant. That's a little bit of a cliche. But Congressman Keating went further than that. He said he believes the state will get the grant. Senator Markey said that the unity the delegation is showing in this letter really does make a difference here. I think part of the reason that unity may be more important than usual is how very, very expensive this project is. Senator Warren told me last week that it may be the most expensive bridge project in the country right now in terms of how much federal funding they're seeking. So it's not like every region of the state is getting one of these, you know, it's a project of statewide and even national significance, really. So having that support from around the state does matter.
Let's turn to some news involving the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe and offshore wind. Yesterday, the tribe and developer Vineyard Offshore announced an agreement to collaborate on offshore wind. Tell us about this.
Sure. This agreement formalizes the working relationship between the tribe and this wind development company, Vineyard Offshore. It creates a community benefit fund called the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe Offshore Wind Community Fund. Their announcement did not give any of the financial details of it, but typically, wind developers who sign a community benefit agreement contribute money for priorities identified by that community. Vineyard Power had an agreement like this with Vineyard Wind that funded work at the Tisbury Marine Terminal, among other things. This new agreement between the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe and Vineyard Offshore, they said, is going to support things like scholarships, wastewater projects, language reclamation, workforce training, and then something else that they're calling tribal capacity to engage with offshore wind projects. That wasn't fully explained, but I'm going to try to find out more about that.
And what did the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe have to say about the announcement?
Chairman Brian Whedon had a statement in writing that was included in the announcement. He says this is a chance for them to have a seat at the table on future wind projects and also a way of protecting the earth for future generations by supporting offshore wind. He said the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe is committed to renewable energy and that having the agreement allows them to work collectively as a tribe in kind of a nation-to-nation relationship with the federal government.
I'm curious about the timing of this announcement. Vineyard Offshore is getting ready to bid on a Massachusetts contract. Is that right?
Yes, in fact, this is the first time that regional bids are allowed between Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut. And an official from Vineyard Offshore confirmed to me that the company does plan to submit a regional bid. The deadline for this round is next Wednesday at noontime, so coming up. And remember, Vineyard Offshore is one of two companies behind Vineyard Wind. So there's the partners of Vineyard Offshore and Avangrid. But this time, Vineyard Offshore is expected to bid separately.
I want to turn now to the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station story that you have been following for so long here, and the question of what will happen to about 1 million gallons of radioactive water still inside the power station. The owner, Holtec, is still seeking a state permit to discharge that water into Cape Cod Bay. And in the meantime, that water is evaporating into the air. You took some time this week to report on what would happen to the water if Holtec were to ship it out of state to a disposal facility. And that's an option that many local activists are calling for. So you talked to Holtec. Tell us, what did you learn?
Well, I talked to the company spokesman, Patrick O'Brien, and he says that if the water were shipped, and what would happen to it once it gets shipped really depends a lot on the timing of the whole thing. And that's because Holtec right now has a waste contract with one company in Texas called Waste Control Specialists. But O'Brien says they may not still have that same contract down the road. And other facilities do different things with the water. So he says the waste company in Texas would most likely mix the radioactive water with a solidifying medium and then bury it as a solid. But in Tennessee, for example, there are other facilities Holtec has looked at that might be more inclined to discharge the water or evaporate it into the air, similar things that are happening here.
So it depends. Tell us kind of the context around here. Why does Holtec say it doesn't want to ship this water? I know you reported that the Vermont Yankee plant shipped far more water than Pilgrim has to deal with as they were decommissioning that plant in Vermont.
That's right. Vermont did ship its water and much more than Pilgrim has in its plant. I asked O'Brien about that, and he said one important difference is that Vermont Yankee has its own rail spur. So the water went by train. But here it would go by tanker trucks, would require many trips. And he says the main reason not to ship the water is safety because of the risk that a tanker accident could spill the radioactive water. But he also talked about the cost of doing that trucking, which is something in the community have zeroed in on as well. You know, they say the people in the community say Holtec doesn't want to ship the water because of how much they would have to spend to do it. O'Brien says that price would be hefty, he said. And 2 years ago, O'Brien wasn't going to put a number on it now, but 2 years ago, the CEO of Holtec, Chris Singh, told Senator Markey in writing that it would cost about $20 million to ship the Pilgrim water. So it doesn't seem like they're anxious to do that. Although O'Brien did reiterate to me his point that they've said frequently that they may want to use all disposal methods at some point in the process. And he said this week that one reason for that is that toward the end of the decommissioning, the concentration of radioactivity in any remaining water in the plant may be such that they would have to ship it for disposal at a licensed facility. But
It's
there's a lot going on there, yeah.
a lot going on there, and it's interesting that they have concerns about shipping it over the roads, but not as much concerns apparently about the safety of just putting it into Cape Cod Bay, which would seem to raise plenty of questions as well, as it has. That's CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Next week marks 11 months since the Environmental Protection Agency released a damaging draft report about a heavy machine gun range proposed for Joint Base Cape Cod. Now some environmentalists are wondering, when will that report be finalized? CAI's Eve Zukov has answers and joins us. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
First, remind us about this report. Why was it so important when it came out?
Yeah, it was huge when it came out. It was a draft report that found a proposed machine gun range on the base would create a significant public health hazard, that's in quotes, by contaminating drinking water. That's because we've got this sole source aquifer here, which means the water supply beneath the base and kind of much of the Upper Cape supplies. Nearly all residents in the Upper Cape are drinking water. And as the EPA says, the proposed range, would nearly quadruple the total annual bullet load that's currently being deposited into the berms and range floors of the active small arms training ranges at the base. We're talking the order of 1.3 million more bullets per year, which could get into soil, then groundwater, and drinking water. So ultimately, the EPA said, if the range were built and the aquifer was further contaminated, because again, the base actually has a long history of already contaminating the aquifer, surrounding towns would need to construct and operate expensive advanced drinking water systems. Really big deal, in the EPA's view.
So in the last few weeks, environmentalists have been sort of poking around asking, why isn't this 11-month-old report being finalized?
Yeah, nearly 11 months since it came out. There were public hearings. There were 1,200 comments roughly submitted. I mean, people really care about this, and we never got a timeline for it. I think people are still scratching their heads about this. And it's a really high consequence. If the report becomes finalized by our regional head of the EPA, our New England head, then it gets sent with a recommendation to EPA Administrator Michael Regan, and he can pull all the funding and effectively doom it.
You reached out to the Environmental Protection Agency. What did they say?
Yeah, ultimately, they still didn't give me a timeline. They just vaguely said they're looking forward to sharing details. But I did find this interesting. A spokesperson said EPA is actively conducting a review of the proposal from the Massachusetts Army National Guard, the body that proposed this range. So after the initial draft report came out, the Guard had 60 days until June 26th of last year to submit new data or a new proposal. And at the time, EPA officials wrote that even if the Guard attempted to address their concerns in some kind of proposal, it was uncertain that any combination of operations, maintenance, and monitoring, this is in quotes, can be developed in such a way as to minimize the release of contaminants to the maximum extent feasible. And kind of continuing from there, paraphrasing, and do enough to reduce this significant public health hazard. That's how they say it. So it's really interesting, I think, that the EPA is looking at the Guard's proposal and that there isn't a ton of public engagement around this.
And how about the Guard? Are they saying anything?
Yeah, the Guard had no comment for me. And if that changes, they know where to find me.
Okay, let's talk about another story you covered this week. You told me this week that if I'm in Hyannis this weekend, I may see a bunch of cars, or trucks to be more specific, with red and white flags on them. And explain to us what is going on this weekend.
Yes. Okay. So hundreds of lobstermen from all across Massachusetts are gathering in Hyannis over the next couple of days for an annual meeting and industry trade show. Yeah, they've got these little flags that have like red and white, and there's a lobster in the center. They looked like Canadian flags to me when I first saw them. But that's what people will probably start seeing even if they're on the roads this morning. happening. It's a 3-day event at the Emerald Resort and Conference Center on Scudder Ave. And yeah, it's bringing together the fishermen with fishery regulators and researchers and law enforcement. There will also be time to for lobstermen to talk with roughly 50 vendors at booths. They're selling everything from lobster traps to boat propellers, but it's really meant to be fun. There's cooking demos, bingo, Elvis impersonator, etc.
Real briefly, is there anything in particular you're looking forward to that stands out in this year's program?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the conversations about offshore wind. A representative from Vineyard Wind will be there to talk about a compensation fund for fishermen affected by this development 15 miles south of Martha's Vineyard, because fishermen, all kinds of fishermen, have until June 3rd to show that they've historically used the lease area, and then this $19.1 million pot will be divided up amongst fishermen.
Okay, we've got about a minute left, but I want to ask you about a story that made national headlines this week. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis floated the possibility of sending Haitian migrants to Martha's Vineyard, kind of a repeat of what happened in 2022 when he was involved in sending about 50 mostly Venezuelan migrants to the island. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so on a podcast, Governor Ron DeSantis, kind of flippantly said, quote, we do have our transport program that's also going to be operational, so Haitians land in the Florida Keys. Their next stop may well be Martha's Vineyard. Then the host of this podcast asked DeSantis if he had any immediate plans to send migrants to the Vineyard, Maryland, or other places. And DeSantis said, quote, well, hopefully it doesn't come to that, but I think that we're going to be ready. So we obviously wanted to look into this. I made some calls over the island to the people who would be in charge of a response to that kind of event. There wasn't any immediate action over there because, like anyone, you know, we don't know how real this is as journalists, as kind of anyone outside of the DeSantis political machine. But because this kind of thing has happened before, we're following it closely and we will continue to do that.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll check in with Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. As we just heard, speaking with Eve Zukoff, Vineyard Wind has a compensation fund for fishers impacted by the construction of offshore wind. Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us with the story of why some vineyard fishers will likely get left out of that program. Hi, Unki.
Hi, thanks for having me.
To get compensation, these fishermen are supposed to demonstrate that they fished in these disrupted areas in the past few years. But the Times spoke to some who explained that they're likely to be impacted even though they don't fish in those waters. Can you explain that for us?
Sure, Steve. We talked to some fishermen not too long ago, and like you said, they have to kind of prove that they fished in those lease areas where the wind farmers, specifically for Vineyard Wind, in terms of this compensation program. However, according to the folks we talked with, there isn't really going to be any fishermen not from the vineyard who will receive the compensation program funding. But even so, even if they can't show that they, you know, fished or whatnot, they told us that with the construction and all that's going on, some more fishermen who might not usually be going where they may go, such as to go lobstering or whatever it may be, it kind of shrinks the amount of, shrinks their slice of the pie, if you will, to get their living.
So these vineyard fishermen, even though they haven't necessarily been actively fishing in the waters where the offshore wind is being constructed, the fishermen who are being displaced by that are likely to come in and fish in areas where the vineyard fishermen have already been fishing, which means, as you say, it's shrinking their slice of the pie there. It's putting more pressure on vineyard fishermen who already the commercial fishing community is really kind of hard-pressed with all the challenges they face. Is that right?
That's right, Steve. That's what we were told. And you know, they did get some credit to Vineyard Wind. Vineyard Wind has been trying to listen to them, trying to reach out to them and whatnot. But they feel there could be some room for improvement and some level of compensation to vineyard fishers for what they think is going to be an impact to them. Plus, it's not only Vineyard Wind. Like, we talk about them a lot just because they're pretty close. They're getting their turbines up right now, but there are several projects in the works, like in water south of the Vineyard. So, yeah, those are also some lingering concerns for folks.
So, and as also as they're having this conversation about this particular compensation fund, they're looking ahead to these other projects and trying to make sure that if they are compensation funds, they're set up to acknowledge some of the knock-on impacts that fishermen may be feeling.
That's right, Steve. And in the process of the story, we also talked to one guy. He's like 17. He wants to go into the lobstering business, but he feels that, you know, that going into the business itself, it's costly. There's some uncertainty as is with regulation and all that jazz. But he feels that the offshore wind industry also kind of adds to that pressure and makes it uncertain whether this will be like a viable career path. And he's not the only one from what we hear.
Okay, I want to ask you about another story in the paper this week. A state representative seat is up for grabs this fall for our region. Now a well-known island housing advocate has announced that she's running. Tell us about this.
That's right. So that seat was held by Dylan Fernandez. Right now, we have a West Tisbury resident in Ariel Faria who has decided to run for that seat. So she'll be representing the Vineyard, Nantucket, and part of the families in the Massachusetts State House.
And she is known on the island as a housing advocate. Tell us just a little bit about her background.
Sure. So she's running as a Democrat. She works with the Island Housing Trust and runs like their social media stuff as well. But she also was one of the speakers when a lot of the islanders from both Vineyard and Nantucket went to the State House to rally in favor of policies to get more affordable housing to the islands. So, yeah, she's been working to get that going.
And it is kind of still early in all of this. She joins Falmouth Democrat Thomas Moakley as the other announced candidate for the seat, but we'll be watching to see who else comes out and pulls papers, I guess.
That is true, yeah. I mean, even if it's early, she's gotten an endorsement so far from former Massachusetts Housing Secretary Dan O'Connor. He served under former Governor Deval Patrick. And, you know, we talked with State Senator Julian Sear. He didn't quite give an endorsement, but he did say she has a proven track record as a leader in terms of housing and all that. So, yeah, but like you said, it's still early in the races. We'll see who else comes up to try to go for that seat.
Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Unki, thank you.
Thank you.
Chatham continues its efforts to be resourceful in addressing its housing crisis where it can. Now it's looking at deed restrictions calling for year-round residency in some homes. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us to explain. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
This is right now just an idea that the town is exploring, but it has been put into place elsewhere. The town would pay homeowners for these restrictions. Explain how this might work.
Sure. Basically, the town would negotiate with a homeowner to purchase a deed restriction, and that deed restriction would require that the property in question either be occupied by the owner on a year-round basis or rented to someone who occupies it on a year-round basis. Now, these would be totally voluntary. It would be up to the property owner and the town to negotiate the amount of any kind of deed restriction. And the deed restriction would run with the property so that if the property is sold, whoever buys that property would either have to live there year-round or rent it to someone who lives there year-round. And the idea, of course, is to promote year-round residency, to make it possible for people to rent a home, people who work in the community to rent a home here. And it's been really difficult, not only in Chatham, but in most of the Cape because of the recent increases in housing values for working people to find places to live, either to rent or to own.
So this program, which seems like a creative approach to trying to create more year-round housing, it needs to be signed off on by the state before anything like that can happen. But it's modeled on a program that was already in place in Vail, Colorado. Is that right?
Correct. This program, a similar program, has been in place in Vail since 2017. And, you know, that community shares a lot of demographics with Cape Town's seasonality and ages and things like that, and the same sort of problems with housing. Now, that town has spent more than $11 million on this program. The average amount that they pay for a deed restriction is $69,000. This program has been on the radar of housing advocates in the Cape and in the state, actually, for a bit. Last year, both Provincetown and Nantucket filed home rule petitions based on this same program. And State Senator Julian Sear also filed a local option bill that would allow towns to adopt this program. And he's basically has told local towns, he's asked them to show support for this type of program by filing their own home rule legislation. And that's what Chatham is planning to do. There was a petition to place an article to have the selectmen file local legislation for this program. Because it had the right amount of signatures, it will be on the warrant for the annual town meeting May 13th. Basically, it wouldn't institute the program, but it would allow the selectmen to file the legislation at the state level to ask the state lawmakers to allow the town to do this.
It really is indicative of how Chatham is trying to look at every tool in the box to try to create more local housing.
Yeah, Chatham they've been really proactive in the last year or two in this realm. As we know, they're currently looking at two affordable housing projects, which could produce up to 100 units. And the town has also waiting for state action on other home rule legislation, which would allow the town to impose a tax or a surcharge on home sales of above $2 million, with that money going towards affordable housing initiatives.
It is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, where you can read all about it. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
In Provincetown, just three companies own 40% of the hotel rooms. Now there's a move to limit further consolidation in the town. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent joins us to explain what's going on. Hi, Ed.
Good morning, Steve. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be back. This is a petition article that's been put forward. Explain what the concern is here. Like, what's the red flag with this hotel ownership?
Well, yes. So this is Article 24 on the Provincetown annual town meeting warrant, which is happening soon, April 1st. And the petitioners, Elias Duncan and Brent Daly, say that they are concerned about out-of-town companies buying up hotels, and they want to resist corporate control of the town's identity. As you mentioned, just three companies now own 40% of the 1,380 licensed hotel rooms in Provincetown. This is obviously a major piece of the town's economy. And so the biggest one of these companies is the Linkris Hotel Corporation, which owns 31%. They own the Surfside Hotel, the Harbor Hotel, Brass Key Guest House, the Crown Point Inn, and just in December, they bought the Provincetown Inn and the Foxbury Inn. And Daly and Duncan point out that Linkris recently announced a plan to turn its Cape Codder resort in Hyannis into a, quote, Margaritaville resort. Daly asks, how much does one person or corporation get to own a paradise?
So, and especially if these corporations aren't immediately related to the town, like they're not based in the town, right? But all of these corporations, it turns out, are based in Massachusetts, but none of them are on the Cape. So their decisions aren't immediately, you know, impacting a community that they're a part of in that way, I guess. Is that part of the concern there?
Well, that's part of their argument, yes. So Lindquist, for example, is based in Plymouth. And the president of Lindquist, Bob Anderson, when we reported back in January on them buying the Provincetown Inn with its 102 hotel rooms, he said, "We love Provincetown. I can look out the window of my office in Plymouth and see the Pilgrim Monument." But in spite of those assurances, they're not local. They don't live here. They bought the hotel from the Evans family, which had owned it. You know, a local family had owned it since 1977. And people are concerned that they don't really understand or care that much about the local, you know, identity here.
Well, tell us about this proposed bylaw, and there are concerns raised about it as well, about whether this could really be put into place and what the legal implications could be.
Well, yes. So this would operate through the town's licensing authority. Unlike, for example, Provincetown has a formula business bylaw, which is part of its zoning laws. But the idea of limiting corporate, you know, control through licensing has not been tried before on Cape Cod. It has been done in other states, though. So, for example, Pennsylvania has a law requiring that funeral homes must be owned by licensed funeral directors, and no one director can own more than two. And North Dakota also has a law similar to that about pharmacies that has been challenged in court and upheld by the Supreme Court in 1973. But people in Provincetown, especially on the select board, expressed some trepidation about possible litigation. So Austin Miller, one of the select board members, said that the town would be going up against people with lots and lots of money for lawyers. One issue is that often owners of businesses will create, you know, shell companies or LLCs with different names. And it wouldn't necessarily be that easy for the town to know whether one owner owns many different properties. Mm. So the town would have to impose some additional requirements on, you know, requiring disclosure of the actual owners, and that could be complicated.
Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Steve. Thank you.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We are going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Nantucket has been dealing with the tragic loss of an island teenager in a car accident. Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current joins us with this story and more. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
The community has really come together here, it sounds like, especially the school community. Tell us what's happened.
Yeah, it's been a sad week on the island. This incident happened last Saturday night, late in the night. When a car, work van, went off the road, tragically killing a 17-year-old student at Nantucket High School. And as we learned, as the community learned, that this was another tragedy for the island, and this is the second, sadly, student that we've lost from this class over the last 2 years, the school came together Monday morning. High school was in session. They had counselors and a mobile crisis unit, and the students actually themselves organized a vigil outside the high school to sort of grieve together and share stories about this student and who he was. And they actually got together at the crash scene. But this boy was 17. His name is Chris Lemus. His family is from El Salvador. So in the aftermath of all this, the school community, the church community at St. Mary's, where there's a large Spanish-speaking mass, and Father Carlos at St. Mary's got together and started to raise funds for the family to help bring this boy's body back to El Salvador. So very sad time for the students, for the community. But as you said, people have been coming together to support each other and support the family.
I want to ask you about another story this week. Nantucket is one of only two towns in the state that operates its own nursing home. Now it's looking at creating a new facility to replace the existing one. Is that right?
That's right. So we have, as you said, one of the only municipally run nursing homes in the state. It's a huge undertaking for the town, but given our geography, it's been a priority for town leaders to sustain a nursing home on the island. If this was to ever go away, there's very unlikely that a private company would come in and that island residents would have access to those types of services here, which would entail, you know, going off island and a lot of hardship for families dealing with, you know, the care that they need for their elders. So this week, the select board unveiled the plans for the new facility, new nursing home on the island, and this would be in a new location. The current building facility that's in use was built in 1980. It's right on Nantucket Harbor, you know, it's been recognized for some time. This has been looked at for over a decade about the possibility of a new facility, where to put it, how big should it be, and so those details really came into focus this week with the presentation and the site where it's going to go, the relocation to South Shore Road. What we don't know yet is the cost. We know it's going to be a big number for taxpayers to swallow. The select boards was talking about that, and that's the sort of next step. But they did give their unanimous endorsement to pursue this concept and start getting some cost estimates for what is expected to be, you know, a facility in excess of $50 million. So a huge undertaking, one of the biggest projects that the town is going to be taking on, and we're going to be learning more about this as the months go on here.
It's Jason Gratzaday of Nantucket Current. Jason, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Members of the Massachusetts House and Senate are working through different bills as they negotiate tighter controls on guns. It's one of several measures making its way through the State House at Beacon Hill. Our State House correspondent Katie Lannon spoke about this and other stories with Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, Katie.
Hello, good morning.
Katie, last week the Senate unanimously passed a child care bill. What does it call for specifically, and what could it mean for a family of four, argument's sake?
So this bill does a lot of things. One of the ones that would have the most impact directly that people would see is it would make more families eligible for state subsidies for childcare. So if you take a family of four, the current eligibility threshold is they would have to earn an annual income below $73,000. This bill proposes to raise that threshold to $124,000. So that's a substantial increase. It would make a lot more families eligible. For families that do receive those subsidies for childcare, it would also cap the out-of-pocket costs that they pay apart from the subsidies. So really a big push there to make childcare more affordable for families, as well as to stabilize the field as a whole, to keep workers in early education by boosting their pay, by helping them move up into more advanced jobs in that field, and also make permanent a grant program for childcare providers, keeping those institutions with a steady flow of state dollars to help them stay afloat.
Also, a new grant program will help cities and towns repurpose empty office space into housing. I think this is a great story. But how realistic is it, Katie, and would it be based on a lottery?
So this is a grant program which cities and towns would actually apply for. So it'd be anyone across the state with a downtown and a population of under 250,000. So that's pretty much everywhere except Boston. It's cities and towns outside of the capital city. And what it does is it tries to address challenges in converting office buildings. You know, you think they don't have showers. There might be one bathroom per floor. They're set up very differently than housing. So this program wants to help communities find out what buildings would work, because this is, as you say, it's a challenging endeavor. It's not easy to build any sort of housing, given the costs and the regulations we have here in Massachusetts. And this is an extra layer of difficulty on top of that.
All right. Well, this next one will affect anyone who has ever used an app to hail a ride. Listen up, Uber folks, Lyft, whatever you take. These companies are pushing to get certain questions on the ballot in November. What is it they want, Katie?
Yeah, this has been a long-running goal of companies like Uber and Lyft to define their drivers under Massachusetts state law as independent contractors rather than employees. The companies and the industry has five different versions of a proposed ballot question that would establish that driver status, some of which would also provide new benefits. Meanwhile, some labor groups are pushing a question that would allow drivers to unionize in order to have that collective power to negotiate their working conditions. So it's going to be really interesting to see what lawmakers decide to do here, because they can try and broker a deal between the two sides to keep these questions off the ballot, to avoid a confusing situation where voters who may not know much about employment law are asked to weigh in on two different aspects of the driver-app relationship.
Yeah, it's a real fine line, to be sure. Well, finally, Katie, the House and Senate have started negotiating their diverging gun bills. You've done some great reporting this week on it. Are they finding common ground? What is it that they can accomplish?
So in an interesting move, so far after the first meeting, these negotiations haven't been closed to the press. They're usually conducted behind closed doors when you get to this stage of the process. So hopefully we'll be able to follow along as this plays out. You know, so far we've seen the lawmakers from each side stressing the similarities between the bill. Both want to, for example, help law enforcement crack down on ghost guns, those untraceable homemade weapons. But there's big differences beyond that. The Senate bill, for instance, would ban advertising guns to minors. The House bill takes a more expansive look at adding people to the list of those who could petition the courts to suspend someone's gun license over safety concerns. So there's a lot they're going to hash out, and maybe about 4 months to do it if they want to try to get a final bill to Governor Healey by the end of formal sessions for the year. So I guess the clock's ticking there.
Indeed it is. Katie Lannon, as always, we appreciate your insight from the State House. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is CAI's Patrick Flannery speaking with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. New Bedford is the nation's top dollar fishing port, and that's largely because of the scallop fishery. But this season's harvest has been down, and now a new threat seems to be appearing. Will Sennett of the New Bedford Light has the story and joins us. Hi, Will.
Hey, morning, Steve.
Will, your article points to rising pressures on the local fishery coming from imported Japanese scallops. And to add even more intrigue, you link this in part to the failed nuclear power station Fukushima. Explain how this all comes together.
Yeah, so the global seafood supply chain is incredibly complex. And there's always a lot of factors that add to this challenging scallop year for fishermen and vessel owners. You know, one is increasing costs, you know, increasing fuel, fewer days at sea, shorter landings. But there is this one new trend, which is this really high spike in imported Japanese scallops, specifically from Japan. We've seen in the last few years the number climb from 5 million up to 18 million pounds a year. And, you know, that's compared with the domestic landings dropping from about 50 million pounds down to just under 25 million pounds. So it's a real inverse relationship. But yeah, there is it is a pretty interesting story when you think of the this relationship to the political situation in Japan. If you recall, the earthquake in Fukushima in 2011 was a deadly earthquake, and one of the main problems is that it crippled their nuclear power plant. It was a real disaster for Japan, and they've been working ever since to decommission the plant. And a major step in that took place in August of 2023, when they started discharging the nuclear waste water from that plant into the ocean. It was a move that was necessary for Japan to, you know, decommission the plant, but it was one that was seen by China and, you know, neighboring countries like South Korea as a threat to their shared oceans and their, you know, shared seafood industries. And they responded by imposing a ban on all Japanese seafood. China and South Korea were the two main buyers of Japanese seafood, and that ban put their prices in absolute freefall. I mean, you saw their imports decline by over 90%. And as a result, Japanese seafood prices tanked. Ever since then, Japan has been looking to break into other markets. They've been running, you know, very targeted advertisements, and even in the U.S. on networks like CNN. I believe there was even one Super Bowl commercial specifically for Japanese scallops, which is a major industry over there, just as much as it is in New Bedford. And they have been successful, and it's been a, you know, real PR campaign that's worked. And, you know, Japanese scallops are becoming, you know, a new major commodity in the American seafood supply.
So as you kind of pointed to a little bit in the beginning here, the local landings of scallops have really dropped in recent years. Explain some of what's happening there as people seem to understand it.
Yeah, so like all fisheries, these things work in a cycle. At least that's what regulators say. You know, it's this, you know, it's a kind of fishery where it goes through years of abundance and years of decline. And right now we're coming off a major, you know, all-time high for the scallop industry. You know, landings were some of the highest in the whole fisheries history, over 60 million pounds a year back in 2019. And prices were incredibly high too. Part of that is a pandemic era, you know, economics where there was, you know, limited imported supplies, and, you know, the domestic supply was really the main one in the supply chain. But since then, there's been a slow decline. The resource has been struggling, as regulators put it, which is a real threat for New Bedford, where it's, you know, scallops in, you know, the U.S.'s top earning commercial fishing port really set the tone for the whole industry. They account for over 80% of all the landings here, and yeah, it's dropped by over 50% since that high in 2019. So, yeah, not only is there less scallops to be caught, but those same scallops are now going for less due to this, you know, increased imports that are needed to fill the supply that the domestic landings can't make up.
It is an interesting part of fishing that the prices that fishermen are paid are often not reflected in the price that people pay at the fish market. So the retail prices of scallops remain quite consistent.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, one, you know, you might look at this story and say, oh, wow, you know, prices of scallops are dropping. That's great. I love scallops. Mm-hmm. Maybe I can afford them now. But the retail prices have not dropped at all. I mean, you look at Walmart or Fulton Fish Market's website, and you see scallops are still, you know, over $30 a pound retail. The only thing dropping is the price that's paid to fishermen at the dock, and that is, you know, all based on the market and what the buyers are just able to get from the fishermen. It's a negotiation, and it's not going to a thing that. You know, this lower cost does not pass on to the consumers in any way.
And fishermen looking ahead to 2024 as the fishing year, they have a sense of what the season might line up to be like?
Yeah, it's more rough waters ahead, they're saying. But there is some hope that, you know, these declines in, you know, the scallop resources are cyclical. The areas now are in a bit of a rough patch, but you know, it's a rotational fishery, so they fish different areas at different years. And a lot of the areas that are closed to fishing now show a lot of promise. They're just not open yet for scallop fishing. So it's one of these things where there's kind of been a holding pattern waiting for the new areas to open up to catch more scallops.
Will Sennett of the New Bedford Light. Will, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
That is our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We spoke with Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent, Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current, CAI's Patrick Flannery. Spoke with our State House reporter Katie Lennon, and we spoke with Will Sennett at the New Bedford Light. Big thank you to Amy Vince for engineering the program. That's it for today. Talk to you next week in Woods Hole. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.